You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to all the recent polls, the American people have lost faith in the Senate. It's an institution that has come to be associated in the public's mind with provincial partisanship and profound dysfunction. It was referred to in The New Yorker recently as an empty chamber. In his new book, The Last Great Senate, Ira Shapiro, who had senior positions for a dozen years in Congress, serving members of both parties, reminds us that this has not always been the case by looking primarily at the years of the Carter presidency from 1976 to 1980, a time when the Senate routinely transcended partisanship to deal with the complicated issues of the day. His book is published by Perseus Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ira Shapiro to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
So how long has this book been percolating in your mind? did it start when you started seeing the major changes, the growing polarization in Congress?
Well, I've had a lifelong interest in the Senate. I actually went there as a summer intern for Jacob Javits of New York one day after graduating college a long time ago, 1969. Then I worked 12 years in the Senate that ended in 1987 and continued to follow it. In mid-2008, a group of us who used to work together were getting together for breakfast periodically to discuss the election because the campaign was so exciting. And we would turn our attention at some point to the Senate and remember how wonderful it had been and how unrecognizable it had become. And I decided I would write about the Senate as I remembered it.
Now, you started off working for a Republican, Jacob Javits, although today he probably would be a Democrat. But is it common for somebody to have worked for people in both parties?
No, it's not that common, but summer internships are a little different. People forgive you for those. But Javits, of course, was perhaps the most liberal Republican, so I probably could have transcended it anyway.
Weren't there senators even then who were just as partisan as the people we see today? I'm thinking of Jesse Helms, Orrin Hatch. I could probably come up with about 10 other names at least.
I think the book deals with the closing years, as I refer to them, the last years of that great Senate that we had in the 1960s and the 1970s. There were certainly some people who were very partisan, but for the most part, they were the exceptions. I describe the Senate a little bit as almost a demilitarized zone where partisanship was concerned.
So if it was so effective, why do we think of those years when Jimmy Carter was in the White House as a failed presidency?
Well, to some extent, these were the last years of what I call the progressive Senate. The politics of the country were definitely moving to the right. We had a new set of problems that had to do with the U.S. weakened economy from about 1973 on. The point of the book, from my standpoint, was that even with these difficulties, the Senate continued to operate in a bipartisan way, helped Carter to a number of major accomplishments, and in the 1980 election, the Senate was shattered by the Reagan landslide.
Had you been hopeful that the election of Barack Obama, who had come out of the Senate, might lead to another golden era?
Barack Obama ran for the presidency for many reasons, one of which was he was afraid he'd get trapped in the Senate if he stayed, because he looked around and said, this is getting pretty dysfunctional. But I would say that some of his critics say that President Obama was naive for thinking he could transcend partisanship. Count me as naive as well. Despite all the years I've been in Washington, I actually believe the national narrative that in a time of economic crisis, we would come together. And I think that it was quite disturbing in 2009 to see that the Republicans, particularly using the Senate, followed the strategy of absolute obstruction.
It was interesting that that presidential race involved two senators, two sitting senators. Often when senators become president, they actually do well because they understand how the game is played.
Well, we go through cycles, as you know, Leonard. I mean, in the early period of the great Senate, the early 60s. For a long time, we just had senators. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon had been a senator. All the candidates were senators.
But we were already seeing some kind of divide. Goldwater was a senator as well.
Sure.
And some people say that this polarization, this growing partisanship, actually dates back to the Goldwater campaign.
Well, I think if you take the long view, I think the Goldwater campaign and the election of 1964 marked an important juncture. Johnson won a landslide victory, but the South became Republican. And Johnson, of course, made the famous observation that after the Civil Rights Act of 64, we've lost the South forever.
But he also ran one of the most nasty ads in the history of America, one we remember quite well. And it may have been the first political ad to do the kind of thing that now has become a commonplace, but has upset a lot of people. I mean, he was accusing Barry Goldwater of being
going
likely to start a nuclear war.
Right. No, that ad broke new ground without question. On the other hand, if you look forward, what you discover is, I think, the late 70s that I wrote about in the book broke new ground because that was the first time that you had the single interest political action committees on abortion, on guns, on NCPAC at the time.
So running for Senate starting to cost a lot more money? Nothing like today, of course.
No, that's
And
right.
There was no 24-hour media surveillance of activities in Congress.
Nothing like today.
No C-SPAN.
No 24-hour news. No political conversation through Facebook and Twitter. And certainly not the same kind of demands for time and for money to raise money. Absolutely true. I always say it's harder to be a senator now than it was, but my sympathy only goes so far. I think they could still do a lot better.
How does the Senate compare to governmental institutions elsewhere? It's not the equivalent of the British House of Lords because it's much stronger.
No, that's right. I mean, it's unique in the world, and some people have called it, one of the authors called it, the single unique piece of genius by the founding fathers. It's a much more powerful upper body than anywhere else. On the other hand, throughout history, and particularly in the 20th century, until the Senate I write about, the Senate had failed us on a routine basis.
Well, the senators, until fairly recently, were appointed rather than elected. And we have had some people calling for a return to that.
Well,
would that make senators more responsible?
I don't think we need them to be appointed. And that was 1913. We've gone a long way since then. But what I was thinking of was in the 20th century, particularly up to around 1958, 1960, what you had was the Senate as really a bastion of reaction. It was the place, as one author wrote, the only place where the South did not lose the Civil War. The South's unending revenge for Gettysburg. And so it was profoundly undemocratic for a long time. And then we had the period I write about, which is a progressive period.
You may think of the Senate as permanently dysfunctional, but that hasn't always been the case, which is why we're discussing the past with Ira Shapiro now. He has written a book called The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. You're a liberal Democrat, writing about a time when liberal Democrats ran the Senate. So isn't there a certain personal bias here?
Well, I think that I'm unabashedly a progressive Democrat. And so the bias might be considered. On the other hand, my critique of the Senate since 1980 is one that's shared widely by moderate and moderate conservative Republicans.
So this is not really a partisan remembrance of things past? A Republican could have written something similar?
I think so.
A Republican who had served in Congress at that time?
I think so. And it was really striking at that time how bipartisan the senators were, and it permeated to all of us at the staff level. We were told if you had some legislative idea and the senator liked it, if you were a Democrat, go find a Republican, and you could find them.
You start the book with Senator Evan Bayh announcing that he would not seek a third term in the Senate. Now, his name, Bi, he was as bipartisan as you could be. He voted with Republicans almost as much as he voted with Democrats.
Right.
Outraging members of his party. Was that a good thing?
He found himself very frustrated because there were so few people on both sides that were bipartisan.
Ben Nelson is another one. The Democrats were happy to see him go recently.
Well, that's right. It's become more partisan. Both sides have moved a little bit. Well, both sides have moved. I would say the Republicans have moved repeatedly right and then further right. But the contrast I draw in the beginning of the book is when I say Evan Bi was frustrated about a lot of things, but mostly he was frustrated that it wasn't his father's Senate. It wasn't what he grew up hearing about, the great Senate that Birch Bi had served in.
And it had already become more polarized.
Yeah.
Some people are saying that that was a result of Newt Gingrich's polarization in the House and then some House members moving over to the Senate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alan Simpson, Senator Alan Simpson, who's still prominent because of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, has said that the Senate changed when the battered children from the House came over, led by Trent Lott. They came over and they were determined to make the Senate more like the House, more partisan, more hard-edged, and they succeeded.
But before that, in this period that you say was a remarkable period for the Senate, 1960 through 1980, we have a lot of social and political upheaval, Vietnam,
yes,
civil rights, the war on poverty, finally Watergate. And Watergate is interesting because when we think back to the hearings on Nixon, Republicans were just as critical of him, or some anyway,
yes,
as Democrats. We couldn't see something similar during the Clinton impeachment hearings.
Right. Exactly. What you saw in the period you just described, you saw a period where the Senate was at the forefront of everything, from the Civil Rights Act to 1964, to the opposition to Vietnam, to Watergate holding Nixon accountable, and because it was bipartisan.
But in the wake of the Watergate scandal, wasn't there distrust in this country of the institutions of government, including the Senate?
I think there was general distrust of the institutions of government, and that was one reason Jimmy Carter got elected president. He was an outsider, and that served him very well.
I mean, despite the fact that there were so many distinguished senators,
yes,
who could have run, we wind up with a governor from Georgia.
Well, and the distinguished senators, many of whom did run, ended up splitting the vote. And so Carter was able, as a plurality in primaries, he moved ahead. But clearly, there was a yearning for something outside. It was a time, as you remember, there was a great deal of cynicism about government, but also other institutions. A lot of concern about the military, police, etc. It was a difficult and cynical time.
My guess is Ira Shapiro, who came to Washington in 1975 and spent 12 years serving in senior positions in the Senate, playing a role as diverse as working for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and completing the monorail system. He has written a book called The Last Great Senate: Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ira Shapiro, who's written a book called The Last Great Senate: Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, published by Public Affairs. And the period you write about is the period you worked in the Senate. Why did you leave?
Well, I had been there 12 years. I felt I had done a number of things that I enjoyed doing, and it was time to try something else. I had just turned 40. I had to save a little money for my daughter and son to go to college.
So let's talk about some of the leaders during this time. Hubert Humphrey actually regained his Senate seat in 1970 after he lost his presidential bid. That's a rarity. It happened in the 19th century a few times, but did it ever happen in the 20th century other than with Humphrey?
Not sure I remember another time.
Taft?
No, I guess, Dan Coats went back to the Senate recently in Indiana, mm-hmm. although I think he had retired. He hadn't been defeated. He reclaimed a seat. Humphrey was, I think, one of the most remarkable senators that ever served. But I also, because of his extraordinary leadership on civil rights and nuclear disarmament, nuclear testing, other acts, other situations. But I think of him as a tragic figure because of his vice presidency.
And then he was denied the majority leader position, you would have assumed, because of his seniority and because of his knowledge of the workings of Washington, that he would have been given that position. It was given to Robert Byrd instead.
Well, but Humphrey had been out of the Senate for key years.
He was seen as damaged goods?
Well, he was damaged at first by the Vietnam War, but when he got back and the Vietnam War ended, he sort of rebuilt himself in the Senate. But he repeatedly ran for president, and then he was afflicted with cancer. When he ran against Robert Byrd in 1977, put himself forward to be majority leader, it was not a good thing to have done because he wasn't even healthy.
But Robert Byrd was also considered damaged because he had a lot of baggage, didn't he, from his past? And also just, I don't know whether earmarks were as big an issue in those days as they are today and whether he got as many earmarks as Rick Santorum did, $1 billion, I guess, in a very brief time in Congress.
Robert Byrd made Santorum look like a piker. But earmarks were not the same then. They were not regarded the same way. And West Virginia's poverty had been regarded as a national issue since John Kennedy had gone there in 1960. So Byrd not only represented his state, but thought he was doing the work of the nation. But certainly he had to overcome his background as an opponent of civil rights. He was really a leading opponent of something that was the moral imperative for most Democrats. But time passed. He moderated his views. He muted his views. And the civil rights legislation had passed, and that era was behind us.
And to some degree, he even positioned himself as the kind of moral compass for the Senate at times.
Well, he was...
He's the guy who gave that speech that others were afraid to give.
Well, but that was later. I mean, at that time, he was in the 60s and 70s. He was becoming more experienced. He was helping the Senate. He made the Senate trains run on time. The objections to him disappeared, and I described this 10-year period in which the idea of Byrd as leader went from being inconceivable to inevitable.
A former KKK member.
Inconceivable to inevitable.
Let's talk a bit about the Senate Minority Leader, Howard Baker.
Baker becomes Minority Leader at the beginning of 1977 when my book starts, when Byrd becomes Majority Leader and Carter becomes President. Baker was one of the most remarkable politicians I think we've ever seen. He epitomized the courage and statesmanship I refer to.
Well, he had to deal with mending fences and everything after the debacle of Watergate, didn't he?
He did, and he did it masterfully. He was perfectly good at bringing together his party, which was pretty diverse, from Javits on the left to Jesse Helms on the right. But he also dealt with the Democrats well. And Baker will always be remembered in Washington for the courage he showed in supporting the Panama Canal treaties when it was completely not in his interest to do so.
Was Jesse Helms more of the kind of senator we see today?
He was a first in my mind. His biographers call him a righteous warrior. And I don't question his sincerity. But he was a first in the sense that he tried to obstruct the Senate and he tried to pursue a right-wing social agenda. He has descendants, and we see them today, particularly in Senator Jim DeMint, and we saw him in Senator Rick Santorum.
So you think he's the early Tea Party candidate before there was a Tea Party?
Well, the Tea Party has more of a budget orientation, and he had, if they had to single out their first priority— Helms' priorities included the social agenda. It's no coincidence in my mind, Leonard, that Helms was elected and came to office in January 1973, the same month that Roe versus Wade was decided.
He had been a Democrat, switched to the Republican Party, as did many conservative Republicans.
Yes, Trent Lott was a Democrat, too, and before he became a Republican.
When Carter was elected, did he enter the White House with a mandate?
No, not really. I think he entered the White House. He won by a very narrow margin.
Despite the fact that Nixon and Gerald Ford had been connected, Ford was blamed for letting Nixon off the hook.
Right. And you remember in the summer of 76, Carter led Ford by 30 points at one time. And then that shrunk as people got uncertain about Carter and they got a little more comfortable with Ford and started forgiving him to some extent for the pardon. Carter didn't really have a mandate, but he had a lot of expectations from Democrats and labor, consumer, poverty groups. So he had the challenge of centering the party and centering the country in a difficult economic time.
But would he share the same view of the Senate that you do? Didn't he come to see it as obstructionist to his agenda?
No. I don't think he did. He actually came to see it as helpful to his agenda because they helped him on a lot of things, despite the fact it took a while for them to get used to each other. Last year, Carter published his White House diary, and in the notes, the more contemporary notes, he writes, "President Obama deals with a lot of the same problems that I was dealing with, but I had one advantage. I had a bipartisan Congress." And by that, he means a bipartisan Senate, because both of them had the same kind of house.
How do you think his tax rebate proposal would fly today?
It wouldn't fly. It didn't fly then. It was regarded as somewhat bizarre.
What did he suggest?
He basically suggested that each person should get $50 back, and it was regarded as a small stimulus but kind of a strange idea, so he pulled back on it.
He made energy a central platform, and looking back at it now, he seems to have been prescient. But at the time, he was seen as a doomsayer.
Well, he was seen, certainly he was seen as somebody who was very serious about energy, and he pursued it every year. And the Senate had some reservations about it, but they worked with him on it. It was like an ordeal each year of the presidency. And after his energy program went into effect, oil imports went down 50%.
But he also, his energy bill produced a filibuster by liberal Democratic senators.
It did. It did. And because, look, until Barack Obama's health care initiative, I think the energy package was probably the most complex legislation the Congress had ever considered. So there were consumer and producer interests clashing. There were regional interests clashing. And yet they found a way to come through it.
Many of the issues we're dealing with today, like energy, the Middle East crisis, and others were handled in a bipartisan manner in the last great Senate, the one of the 70s. And my guest, Ira Shapiro, has written about that in a book called The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why was the Senate concerned with Carter's appointment of Paul Warnke as the head of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency?
Carter wanted to pursue an agenda of nuclear arms control, but at the same time, there were many senators and many people in the country who were skeptical of the Soviet Union and the move in the Nixon administration toward détente with the Soviets. That was particularly true of Henry Jackson of Washington, who was perhaps one of the most powerful senators of all time.
A conservative Democrat.
Conservative Democrat, liberal on domestic things, but his highest priority was a hatred of the Soviet Union, real distrust.
And how much of an impact did the Burt Lance affair have on the relations with the Senate?
I think the Burt Lance affair didn't have any lasting effect on the relations with the Senate, that because I point out in the next year, the Senate had a highly productive year with Carter. What the Lance affair did do, though, was it hurt Carter with the public. He had painted himself as something other than a politician and he had made ethics a big priority. When his best friend and OMB director had all kinds of ethical and financial problems, and Carter didn't deal with them rapidly, it hurt him a lot.
But he also had a style that was unorthodox for Washington. And I'd imagine some of the old entrenched politicians found it rather annoying to see him do these things. He walking the route to his inauguration, selling the presidential yacht, carrying his garment bag that suggested that he was doing his not having somebody else carry his bags. He talked to the nations from his fireside wearing a cardigan sweater.
Well, it was a mixed bag. I mean, to some extent, good politicians can admire good political moves, like walking down Pennsylvania Avenue. People understood that, but certainly Carter's outsider status and his tendency not to consult in the beginning with the Congress and his tendency to basically paint himself as something other than a politician grated on a lot of people. The truth was he was other than a politician. He hated politics and he hated politicians.
The real sticking point for many years has been the Senate's role in foreign affairs. Originally just called advising consent. Hasn't it evolved to become a major headache for presidents trying to pass foreign treaties? The Kyoto Agreement wasn't even introduced to the Senate.
Well, I review in the book a little of the history of treaties, and the truth is the Senate has been a problem for presidents for many treaties. One of the things that was most extraordinary about the Carter presidency is that they succeeded with the Senate in getting the Panama Canal treaties through because they needed two-thirds of the Senate, and they got just two-thirds of the Senate.
As unpopular as that was. Yeah. Today, do you think anybody questions what we did there? Does anyone suggest that we should have held on to the Panama Canal?
No one does. And the truth is the substantive arguments at that time were very strong to the point that William Buckley and George Will, prominent conservatives, supported the Panama Canal treaties. But the Republicans, and this was one of the first times that a major policy issue was carried forward as a political issue. They said, well, we're against this, but even if we lose, it's going to be a great political issue. And it was.
The Carter administration sought congressional authorization to sell fighter planes to Israel, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. We were already selling planes to Israel, weren't we?
Yes.
So was this a way of, by packaging it with Israel, that he could sell them to Egypt and Saudi Arabia as well?
Carter felt that there was a moment in time when it was possible to pursue peace in the Middle East. He felt that Saudi Arabia had a big role to play, and he wanted to do something to show that he recognized its importance. It was a ferocious fight, and the Senate came down on Carter's side, despite the fact that Henry Jackson and Jacob Javits and AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, were against him.
But Howard Baker supported it.
Howard Baker and Abraham Rivikoff did, and it split. So there were, I think, 28 Democrats and 26 Republicans or vice versa. That's how they did it. They listened to arguments. They judged on the merits.
And some people say that the approval of this was crucial to the success of the Camp David Accords.
I think it helped. I think it made Carter, put him in a stronger position to mediate between Begin and Sadat.
We're running out of time, but I didn't want to ignore the what seemed like a war against the cities, especially during the Ford years. We remember the famous headline in the Daily News.
Yes.
Is this a different kind of polarization, urban versus rural, or East Coast versus the Midwest or the South?
Well, what I write about in the book is how the Senate overcame that to give financial relief to New York City in 1978. They were disposed not to do it. The Banking Committee had opposed it. And then they heard the arguments from Governor Hugh Carey and the new mayor, Ed Koch, listened to Senators Moynihan and Javits, and they did do it. even though there was a tax revolt underway at the time. That was the kind of statesmanship that I think they were capable of. There are a lot of divisions in the country now. I'm not sure that urban versus rural is necessarily one I'd focus on, but I think the Republicans have done a lot to polarize and paralyze the Senate.
Well, New Yorkers felt that when the headline, Gerald Ford, New York dropped dead.
At that time, it was true.
We felt that way. One of the other major speeches that people associate with the Carter years is his malaise speech, which was kind of denigrated at the time.
Well, there have been a lot of books written about it, and it was a very unusual speech. And the initial reaction to it in the country was actually somewhat positive. But right after that, Carter purged half the cabinet and precipitated a crisis.
Now, many people say that the polarization also can be dated back to a couple of things that Democrats did, the fight over the nomination of John Tower by George H.W. Bush, Secretary of Defense, the nomination of Robert Bork. Do you think that they have played a major role in changing the way the Senate operates? Because now it's almost impossible for Barack Obama to get any kind of judicial nominee through, even Republicans.
It's no question that a series of battles made the Senate a more acrimonious place. But I'm afraid that I would say that what we have today is the result of a Republican strategy to basically oppose, to the point of not even recognizing almost the legitimacy of Democratic presidents. They did it with Clinton initially. And we weren't as conscious of it because we weren't facing the kind of crisis that President Obama faced when he came into office.
Some people have pointed out that if you look at the current discourse, it sounds like the presidential succession was Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, at 8 years in between,
right,
with growing deficits and so many other issues, have totally disappeared.
I think it's kind of remarkable. The Republicans, before Barack Obama, Leonard, Republicans had won 7 out of 10 presidential elections. But whenever the Democrats win, the Republicans have this sense of grievance that somehow they should still be in office, whether it's 12 years of Reagan Bush or 8 years of George W. Bush.
Sounds like Yankees fans. Ira Shapiro, his book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.